Green Mars, Cassette 4.
The trip from the socket into Sheffield proper was by subway, but Art would have been too miserable to notice a view even if there had been one. Wasted and unsteady, he tiptoed bouncily down a tall hallway after someone from Praxis and collapsed thankfully on a bed in a small room. Martian G felt blessedly solid when he was lying down, and after a while, he fell asleep. When he woke, he couldn't remember where he was. He looked around the little room, completely disoriented, wondering where Sharon had gone and why their bedroom had gotten so small. Then it came back. He was on Mars. He groaned and sat up. He felt hot and yet detached from his body, and everything was pulsing slightly, though the room lights appeared to be functioning normally. There were drapes covering the wall opposite the door, and he stood and walked over and opened them with a single pull. "Hey!" he cried, leaping back. He woke up a second time, or so it felt. It was like the view out an airplane window. Endless open space, a bruise-colored sky, the sun like a blob of lava. And there, far below, stretched a flat rocky plain, flat and round as it lay at the bottom of an enormous circular cliff, extremely circular, remarkably circular, in fact, for a natural feature. It was difficult to estimate how distant the far side of the cliff was. Features of the cliff were perfectly clear, but structures on the opposite rim were teensy. What looked like an observatory could have fit on a pinhead. This, he concluded, was the caldera of Pavonis Mons. They had landed at Sheffield, so really there could be no doubt about it. Therefore, it was some 60 kilometers across the circle to that observatory, as Art recalled from his video documentaries, and 5 kilometers to the floor. And all of it completely empty, rocky, untouched, primordial. The volcanic rock as bare as if cooled the week before. Nothing at all of humanity in it. No sign of terraforming. It must have looked exactly like this to John Boone a half century before. And so... alien. And big. Art had looked into the calderas of Etna and Vesuvius while on vacation from Tehran, and those two craters were big by Terran standards, but you could have lost 1,000 of them in this thing, this hole. He closed the drapes and got slowly dressed, his mouth imitating the shape of the unearthly caldera. A friendly Praxis guide named Adrian, tall enough to be a Martian native but possessing a strong Australian accent, collected him and took him and 6 other new arrivals on a tour of the town. Their rooms turned out to be on the city's lowest level, though it wouldn't be lowest for long. Sheffield was in the process of burrowing downward these days to give as many rooms as possible the view onto the caldera that had so disconcerted Art. An elevator took them up nearly 50 stories and let them out in the lobby of a shiny new office building. They walked out its big revolving doors and emerged on a wide grassy boulevard and walked down it past squat buildings faced with polished stone and big windows, separated by narrow grassy side streets and a great number of construction sites, as many buildings were still in various stages of completion. It was going to be a handsome town, the buildings mostly 3 and 4 stories tall, getting taller as they moved south, away from the caldera rim. The green streets were crowded with people and the occasional small tram running on narrow tracks set in the grass. There was a general air of bustle and excitement, caused no doubt by the arrival of the new elevator. A boom town. The first place Adrian took them was across a boulevard to the caldera rim. She led the 7 newcomers out into a thin, curving park to the nearly invisible tenting that encased the town. The transparent fabrics were held in place by equally transparent geodesic struts anchored in a chest-high perimeter wall. "The tenting has to be stronger than usual up here on Pavonis," Adrian told them, "because the atmosphere outside is still extremely thin. It'll always be thinner than the lowlands, by a factor of 10. She led them out into a viewing blister in the tent wall, and, looking down between their feet, they could see through the blister's transparent deck straight down onto the caldera floor some 5 kilometers below them. People exclaimed in delicious fright, and Art bounced on the clear floor uneasily. The width of the caldera was coming into perspective for him. The north rim was just about as far away as Mount Tamalpais and the Napa Hills when one descended into the San Jose airport. That was no extraordinary distance. But the depth below. The depth. Over 5 kilometers, or about 20,000 feet. "Quite a hole," Adrian said. Mounted telescopes and display plaques with map drawings enabled them to spot the previous version of Sheffield, now lying on the caldera floor. Art had been wrong about the caldera's untouched primeval nature. An insignificant pile of cliff-bottom talus with some shiny dots in it was in fact the ruins of the original city. Adrian described with great gusto the destruction of the town in 2061. The falling elevator cable had, of course, crushed the suburbs east of its socket in the very first moments of the fall. But then the cable had wrapped all the way around the planet, delivering a massive second blow to the south side of town, a blow which had caused an undiscovered fault in the basalt rim to give way. About a third of the town had been on the wrong side of this fault and had fallen the 5 kilometers to the caldera floor. The remaining two-thirds of the town had been knocked flat. Luckily, the occupants had mostly evacuated in the 4 hours between the detachment of Clark and the second coming of the cable, so loss of life had been minimized, but Sheffield had been utterly destroyed. For many years after that, Adrian told them, the site had lain abandoned, a wreck like so many other towns after the unrest of 61. Most of those other towns had been left in ruins, but Sheffield's location remained the ideal place for tethering a space elevator, and when Subarashi began organizing the in-space construction of a new one in the late 2080s, construction on the ground had rapidly followed. A detailed aerological investigation had found no other faults in the southern rim which had justified rebuilding right on the edge on the same site as before. Demolition vehicles had cleared the wreckage of the old town, shoving most of it over the rim and leaving only the easternmost section of town around the old socket as a kind of monument to the disaster, also as the central element of a little tourist industry which had clearly been an important part of the town's income in the fallow years before an elevator had been reinstalled. Adrian's next point on the tour led them out to see this preserved bit of history. They took a tram to a gate in the east wall of the tent, and then walked through a clear tube into a smaller tent which covered the blasted ruins, the concrete mass of the old cable facility, and the lower end of the fallen cable. They walked a roped path that had been cleared of wreckage, staring curiously at the foundations and twisted pipes. It looked like the results of saturation bombing. They came to a halt under the butt end of the cable, and Art observed it with professional interest. The big cylinder of black carbon filaments looked nearly undamaged by the fall, although admittedly this was the part that had hit Mars with the least force. The end had jammed down into the socket's big concrete bunker, Adrian said, then been dragged a couple of kilometers as the cable had fallen down the eastern slope of Pavonis. That wasn't that much of a beating for material designed to withstand the pull of an asteroid swinging beyond the aerosynchronous point. And so it lay there, as if waiting to be straightened up and put back in place. Cylindrical, 2 stories high, its black bulk encrusted by steel tracks and collars and the like. The tent only covered 100 meters or so of it. After that, it ran on uncovered, east along the wide rounded plateau of the rim until it disappeared over the rim's outer edge, which formed their horizon. They could see nothing of the planet below. But out away from the town, they could see better than ever that Pavonis Mons was huge. Its rim alone was an impressive expanse, a donut of flat land perhaps 30 kilometers wide from the abrupt inner edge of the caldera to the more gradual drop-off down the volcano's flanks. Nothing of the rest of Mars could be seen from their vantage point, so it seemed they stood on a high circular ring world under a dark lavender sky. Just to the south of them, the new socket was like a titanic concrete bunker, the new elevator cable rising out of it like an elevator cable, standing alone as if in some version of the Indian rope trick, thin and black and straight as a plumb line dropping down from heaven, visible for only a few tall skyscrapers' worth of height at most, and, given the wreckage they stood in, and the immensity of the volcano's bare rocky peak, as fragile-looking as if it were a single carbon nanotube filament, rather than a bundle of billions of them, and the strongest structure ever made. "This is weird," Art said, feeling hollow and unsettled. After their tour of the ruins, Adrian took them back to a plaza cafe in the middle of the new town where they had lunch. Here they could have been in the heart of a fashionable district in any town anywhere. It could have been Houston or Tbilisi or Ottawa, in some neighborhood where a lot of noisy construction marked a fresh prosperity. When they went back to their rooms, the subway system was likewise familiar to the eye, and when they got out, the halls of the Praxis floors were those of a fine hotel. All utterly familiar, so much so that it was again a shock to walk into his room and look out the window and see the awesome sight of the caldera, the bare fact of Mars, immense and stony, seeming to exert a kind of vacuum pull on him through the window. And in fact, if the windowpane were to break, the pressure blowout would certainly suck him immediately into that space. An unlikely eventuality, but the image still gave him an unpleasant thrill. He closed the drapes. And after that, he kept the drapes closed and tended to stay on the side of his room away from the window. In the mornings, he dressed and left the room quickly and attended orientation meetings run by Adrian, which were joined by a score or so of new arrivals. After lunching with some of them, he spent his afternoons touring the town, working earnestly on his walking skills. One night, he thought to send a coded report off to Fort. "On Mars, going through orientation. Sheffield is a nice town. My room has a view." There was no reply. Adrian's orientation took them to a number of Praxis buildings, both in Sheffield and up the East Rim, to meet people in the Transnational's Martian operations. Praxis had much more of a presence on Mars than it did in America. During Art's afternoon walks, he tried to gauge the relative strengths of the Transnationals just by the little plates on the sides of the buildings. All the biggest Transnats were there. Arms Corps, Tsubarashi, Oroco, Mitsubishi, the Seven Swedes, Shalalko, Gentine, and so on, each occupying a complex of buildings or even entire neighborhoods of the town. Clearly, they were all there because of the new elevator, which had made Sheffield once again the most important city on the planet. They were pouring money into the town, building sub-Martian subdivisions and even entire tent suburbs. The sheer wealth of the Transnats was obvious in all the construction, and also, Art thought, in the way people moved. There were a lot of people bouncing around the streets just as clumsily as he was, newcomer businessmen or mining engineers or the like, concentrating with furrowed brow on the act of walking. It was no great trick to pick out the tall young natives with their cat-like coordination. But they were in a distinct minority in Sheffield, and Art wondered if that was true everywhere on Mars. As for architecture, space under the tent was at a premium, and so the completed buildings were bulky, often cubical, occupying their lots right out to the street and right up to the tent. When all the construction was finished, there would only be a network of 10 triangular plazas and the wide boulevards and the curving park along the rim to keep the town from being a continuous mass of squat skyscrapers faced with polished stone of various shades of red. It was a city built for business. And it looked to Art like Praxis was going to get a good share of that business. Subarashi was the general contractor for the elevator, but Praxis was supplying the software as they had for the first elevator, and also some of the cars and part of the security system. All these allocations, he learned, had been made by a committee called the United Nations Transitional Authority, supposedly part of the UN, but controlled by the Transnats. And Praxis had been as aggressive on this committee as any of the others. William Fort might have been interested in bioinfrastructure, but the ordinary kind was obviously not outside Praxis's field of operations. There were Praxis divisions building water supply systems, train pistes, canyon towns, wind power generators, and aerothermal plants. The latter two were widely regarded as marginal endeavors, as the new orbiting solar collectors and a fusion plant in Xanthi were turning out so well, not to mention the older generation of integral fast reactors. But local energy sources were the specialty of the Praxis subsidiary Power From Below, and so that was what they did, working hard in the outback. Praxis's local salvage subsidiary, the Martian equivalent of dump mines, was called Ouroboros, and like Power From Below, it was also fairly small. In truth, as the Ouroboros people were quick to tell Art when they met one morning, there was not a large garbage output on Mars. Almost everything was recycled or put to use in creating agricultural soil, so each settlement's dump was really more of a holding facility for miscellaneous materials awaiting their particular reuse. Ouroboros therefore got its business by finding and collecting the garbage or sewage that was somehow recalcitrant, toxic or orphaned or simply inconvenient, and then finding ways to turn it to use. The Ouroboros team in Sheffield occupied one floor of Praxis's downtown skyscraper. The company had gotten its start excavating the old town before the ruins had been so unceremoniously shoved over the side. A man named Zephyr headed the fallen cable salvage project, and he and Adrian accompanied Art to the train station where they got on a local train and took a short ride around to the East Rim to a line of suburb tents. One of the tents was the Ouroboros storage facility, and just outside it, among many other vehicles, was a truly gigantic mobile processing factory called The Beast. The Beast made a Super Rathji look like a compact car. It was a building rather than a vehicle, and almost entirely robotic. Another Beast was already out processing the cable in West Tharsis, and Art was slated to go out and make an on-site inspection of it. So Zephyr and a couple of technicians showed him around the inside of the training vehicle, ending up in a wide compartment on the top floor where there were living quarters for any humans who might be visiting. Zephyr was enthusiastic about what the Beast out on West Tharsis had found. "Of course, just recovering the carbon filament and the diamond gel helixes gives us a basic income stream," he said. "And we are doing well with some brecciated exotics metamorphosed in the final hemisphere of the fall. But what you'll be interested in are the buckyballs." Zephyr was an expert in these little carbon geodesic spheres called Buckminster fullerenes, and he waxed enthusiastic. "Temperatures and pressures in the West Tharsis zone of the fall turned out to be similar to those used in the arc reactor synthesis method of making fullerenes, and so there's a 100-kilometer stretch out there where the carbon on the bottom side of the cable consists almost entirely of buckyballs, mostly 60s, but also some 30s and a variety of super buckies." And some of the super buckies had formed with atoms of other elements trapped inside their carbon cages. These full fullerenes were useful in composite manufacturing, but very expensive to make in the lab because of the high amounts of energy required, so they were a nice find. "It's sorting out the various super buckies where your ion chromatography will come in." "So I understand," Art said. He had done work with ion chromatography during analyses in Georgia, and this was his ostensible reason for being sent into the outback. So over the next few days, Zaphir and some beast technicians trained Art in dealing with the beast, and after these sessions they had dinner together at a small restaurant in the suburb tent on the East Rim. After sunset, they had a great view of Sheffield, some 30 kilometers around the curve of the rim, glowing in the twilight like a lamp perched on the black abyss. As they ate and drank, the conversation seldom turned to the matter of Art's project, and, considering it, Art decided that this was probably a deliberate courtesy on his colleague's part. The beast was fully self-operating, and though there were some problems to be solved in sorting out the recently discovered full fullerenes, there must have been local ion chromatographers who could have done the job, so there was no obvious reason why Praxis should have sent Art up from Earth to do it, and there had to be something more to his story. And so the group avoided the topic, saving Art the embarrassment of lies or awkward shrugs or an explicit appeal to confidentiality. Art would have been uncomfortable with any of these dodges, so he appreciated their tact, but it put a certain distance in their conversations, and he seldom saw the other Praxis newcomers outside of orientation meetings, and he didn't know anyone else in town or elsewhere on the planet. So he was a little lonely, and the days passed in an increasing sense of uneasiness, even oppression. He kept the drapes closed on his window view and ate in restaurants away from the rim. It began to feel a bit too much like the weeks on the Ganesh, which he now understood to have been a miserable time. Sometimes he had to fend off the feeling that it had been a mistake to come. And so, after their last orientation lecture at a reception luncheon in the Praxis building, he drank more than was his custom and took a few inhalations from a tall canister of nitrous oxide. Inhalation of recreational drugs was a local custom, fairly big among Martian construction workers, he had been told, and there were even little canisters of various gases for sale from dispensers in some public men's rooms. Certainly the nitrous added a certain extra bubbly quality to the champagne. It was a nice combination, like peanuts and beer, or ice cream and apple pie. Afterward, he walked down the streets of Sheffield, bouncing erratically, feeling the nitrous champagne as a kind of anti-gravitational effect, which, added to the Martian baseline, made him feel altogether too light. Technically, he weighed about 40 kilos, but as he walked along, it felt more like 5. Very strange, even unpleasant, like walking on buttered glass. He nearly ran into a young man slightly taller than him, a black-haired youth, as slender as a bird and as graceful, who quickly veered away from him and then steadied him with a hand to his shoulder, all in one smooth flow of movement. The youth looked him in the eye. "Are you Arthur Randolph?" "Yes," Art said, surprised. "I am. And who are you?" "I'm the one who contacted William Fort," the young man said. Art stopped abruptly, swaying to get back over his feet. The young man held him upright with a gentle pressure, his hand hot on Art's upper arm. He regarded Art with a direct look, a friendly smile. Perhaps 25, Art judged, perhaps younger. A handsome youth with brown skin and thick black eyebrows, and eyes that were slightly Asian, set wide over prominent cheekbones. An intelligent look, full of curiosity and a kind of magnetic quality, hard to pin down. Art took to him instantly for no reason he could tell. It was just a feeling. "Call me Art," he said. "And I am Nergal," the youth said. "Let's go down to Overlook Park." So Art walked with him down the grassy boulevard to the park on the rim. There they strolled the path next to the coping wall, Nergal helping Art with his drunken turns by frankly seizing his upper arm and steering him. His grasp had an electric penetrating quality to it and was really very warm, as if the youth had a fever, though there was no sign of it in his dark eyes. "Why are you here?" Nergal asked, and his voice and the look on his face made the question into something other than a superficial inquiry. Art checked his response, thought about it. "To help," he said. "So you will join us?" Again, the youth somehow made it clear that he meant something different, something fundamental. And Art said, "Yes, any time you like." Nergal smiled, a quick, delighted grin that he only partly overmastered before he said, "Good, very good. But look, I'm doing this on my own, do you understand? There are people who wouldn't approve, so I want to slip you in among us as if it were an accident. That's okay with you?" "That's fine." Art shook his head, confused. "That's how I was planning on doing it anyway." Nergal stopped by the observation bubble, took Art's hand, and held it. His gaze, so open and unflinching, was contact of another kind. "Good. Thanks. Just keep doing what you're doing, then. Go out on your salvage project, and you'll be picked up out there. We'll meet again after that." And he was off, walking across the park in the direction of the train station, moving with the long, graceful lope that all the young natives seem to have. Art stared after him, trying to remember everything about the encounter, trying to put his finger on what had made it so charged. Simply the look on the youth's face, he decided. Not just the unself-conscious intensity one sometimes saw in the faces of the young, but more, some humorous power. Art remembered the sudden grin unleashed when Art had said, had promised, that he would join them. Art grinned himself. When he got back to his room, he walked right to the window and opened the drapes. He went over to the table by his bed and sat and turned on his lectern and looked up Nergal. No person listed by that name. There was a Nergal Vallis between Argyre Basin and Vallis Marineris, one of the best examples of a water-carved channel on the planet, the entry said, long and sinuous. The word was the Babylonian name for Mars. Art went back to the window and pressed his nose against the glass. He looked right down the throat of the thing, into the rocky heart of the monster itself. Horizontal banding of the curved walls, the broad round plain so far below, the sharp edge where it met the circular wall, the infinite shadings of maroon, rust, black, tan, orange, yellow, red, everywhere red, all the variations of red. He drank it in for the first time unafraid. And as he looked down this enormous coring into the planet, a new feeling leaped into him to replace the fear, and he shivered and hopped in place in a little dance. He could handle the view. He could handle the gravity. He had met a Martian, a member of the underground, a youth with a strange charisma, and he would be seeing more of him, more of all of them. He was on Mars. And a few days later, he was on the west slope of Pavonis Mons, driving a small rover down a narrow road that paralleled a band of disturbed volcanic rubble with what looked like a cog railway track running right down it. He had sent a final coded message to Fort telling him that he was taking off and had gotten the only reply of his journey so far. "Have a nice trip." The first hour of his drive held what everyone had told him would be its most spectacular sight, going over the western rim of the caldera and starting down the outer slope of the vast volcano. This occurred about 60 kilometers west of Sheffield. He drove over the southwest edge of the vast rim plateau and started downhill, and a horizon appeared very far below and very far away, a slightly curved hazy white bar, like the view of Earth as seen from a space plane's window, which made sense as the peak of Pavonis was about 85,000 feet above Amazonas Planitia. So it was a huge view, the most forcible reminder possible of the stupendous height of the Tharsis volcanoes, and he had a great view of Arcea Mons at that moment, in fact, the southernmost of the three volcanoes lined up on Tharsis, bulking over the horizon to his left like a neighboring world. and what looked like a black cloud over the far horizon to the northwest could very possibly be Olympus Mons itself. So the first day's drive was all downhill, but Art's spirits remained high. "Toto, there is no chance we are in Kansas anymore. We're off to see the wizard. The wonderful wizard of Mars." The road paralleled the fall line of the cable. The cable had hit the west side of Tharsis with a tremendous impact, not as great as during the final wrap, of course, but enough to create the interesting super buckies Art had been sent out to investigate. The beast he was going down to meet had already salvaged the cable in this vicinity, however, and the cable was almost entirely gone. The only thing left of it was a set of old-fashioned-looking train tracks with a third cog rail running down the middle. The beast had made these tracks out of carbon from the cable and then used other parts of the cable and magnesium from the soil to make little self-powered cog rail mining cars, which then carried salvage cargo back up the side of Pavonis to the Ouroboros facilities in Sheffield. Very neat, Art thought, as he watched a little robot car roll past him in the opposite direction, up the tracks toward the city. The little train car was black, squat, powered by a simple motor engaging the cog track, filled with a cargo that was no doubt mostly carbon nanotube filaments, and capped on top by a big rectangular block of diamond. Art had heard about this in Sheffield, and so was not surprised to see it. The diamond had been salvaged from the double helixes strengthening the cable, and the blocks were actually much less valuable than the carbon filaments stored underneath them, basically a kind of fancy hatch door. But they did look nice. On the second day of his drive, Art got off the immense cone of Pavonis and onto the Tharsis Bulge proper. Here the ground was much more littered than the volcano's side had been with loose rock and meteor craters, and down here everything was blanketed with a drift of snow and sand in a mix that looked like equal shares of both. This was the fern slope of West Tharsis, an area where storms coming in from the west frequently dumped loads of snow, which never melted, but instead built up year by year, packing down the snow on the bottom. So far, the pack consisted only of crushed snow called fern, but after more years of compaction, the lowest layers would be ice, and the slopes, glaciers. Now the slopes were still punctuated by big rocks sticking out of the fern and small crater rings, the craters mostly less than a kilometer across and looking as fresh as if they had been blasted the day before, except for the sandy snow now filling them. When he was still many kilometers away, Art caught sight of the beast salvaging the cable. The top of it appeared over the western horizon, and over the next hour the rest of it reared into view. Out on the vast empty slope, it seemed somewhat smaller than its twin up in East Sheffield, at least until he drove under its flank, when once again it became clear that it was as big as a city block. There was even a square hole in the bottom of one side, which looked for all the world like the entrance to a parking garage. Art drove his rover right at this hole. The beast was moving at 3 kilometers a day, so it was no trick to hit it. And once inside, he drove up a curving ramp, following a short tunnel into a lock. There, he spoke by radio to the beast's AI, and doors behind his rover slid shut, and in a minute he could simply get out of his car and go over to an elevator door and take an elevator up to the observation deck. It didn't take long to realize that life inside the beast was not the essence of excitement, and after checking in with the Sheffield office and taking a look at the ion chromatograph down in the lab, Art went back out in the rover to have a more extensive look around. This was the way things went when working the beast, Zephyr assured him. The rovers were like pilot fishes swimming around a great whale, and though the view from the observation deck was nice and high, most people ended up spending a good part of their days out driving around. So Art did that. The fallen cable out in front of the beast showed clearly how much harder it had been coming down here than it had back at the start of its fall. Here it was buried to perhaps a third of its diameter, and the cylinder was flattened and marked by long cracks running along its sides, revealing its structure, which consisted of bundles of carbon nanotube filament, still one of the strongest substances known to material science, though apparently the current elevator's cable material was stronger yet. The beast straddled this wreckage, about four times as tall as the cable. The charred black semicylinder disappeared into a hole at the front of the beast, from which came a grumbling, low, nearly subsonic vibration. And then, every day at about 2 in the afternoon, a door at the back of the beast slid open over the tracks, always being excreted from the back end of the beast, and one of the diamond-capped train cars would roll out, winking in the sunlight, and glide off toward Pavonis. The trains disappeared over the high eastern horizon into the apparent depression now between him and Pavonis about 10 minutes after emerging from their maker. After viewing the daily departure, Art would take a drive in the pilotfish rover, investigating craters and big isolated boulders and, frankly, looking for Nergal, or rather waiting for him. After a few days of this, he added the habit of suiting up and taking a walk outside for a few hours every afternoon, strolling beside the cable or the pilot fish, or hiking out into the surrounding countryside. It was odd-looking terrain, not only because of the even distribution of millions of black rocks, but because the hard blanket of fern had been sculpted into fantastic shapes by the sandblaster winds, ridges, bowls, hollows, tear-shaped tailings behind every exposed rock, etc. Sastrugi, these shapes were called. It was fun to walk around among these extravagant aerodynamic extrusions of reddish snow. Day after day he did this. The beast ground slowly westward. He found that the windswept bare tops of the rocks were often colored by tiny flakes that were scales of fast lichen, a kind that grew quickly, or at least quickly for lichen. Art picked up a couple of sample rocks and took them back into the beast and read about the lichen curiously. These apparently were engineered crypto-endolithic lichens, meaning they lived in rock, and at this altitude they were living right at the edge of the possible. The article on them said that over 98% of their energy was used simply to stay alive, with less than 2% going toward reproduction. And this was a big improvement over the Terran species they had been based on. More days passed, then weeks. But what could he do? He kept on collecting lichen. One of the cryptoendoliths he found was the first species to survive on the Martian surface, the lectern said, and it had been designed by members of the fabled First Hundred. He broke apart some rocks to have a better look and found bands of the lichen growing in the rock's outer centimeter. First a yellow stripe right at the surface, then a blue stripe under that, then a green one. After that discovery, he often stopped on his walks to kneel and put his faceplate to colored rocks sticking up out of the fern, marveling at the crusty scales and their intense pale colors, yellows, olives, khaki greens, forest greens, blacks, grays. One afternoon, he drove the pilot fish far to the north of the beast and got out to hike around and collect samples. When he returned, he found that the locked door in the side of the pilot fish wouldn't open. "What the hell?" he said aloud. It had been so long that he had forgotten that something was supposed to happen. The happening had taken the form of some kind of electronic failure, apparently. Assuming that this was the happening and not something else. He called in over the intercom and tried every code he knew on the keypad by the locked door, but nothing had any effect. And since he couldn't get back in, he couldn't turn on the emergency systems. And his helmet's intercom had a very limited range, the horizon, in effect, which down here off Pavonis had shrunk to a Martian closeness, only a few kilometers away in all directions. The beast was well over the horizon, and though he could probably walk to it, there would be a section of the hike where both beast and pilot fish would be over the horizon, and himself alone in a suit, with a limited air supply. Suddenly the landscape with its dirty sastrugi took on an alien, ominous cast, dark even in the bright sunshine. "Well, hell," Art said, thinking hard. He was out here, after all, to get picked up by the underground. Nergal had said it was going to look like an accident. Of course, this was not necessarily that accident, but whether it was or it wasn't, panic was not going to help. Best to make the working assumption that it was a real problem and go from there. He could try walking back to the beast, or he could try getting into the pilotfish rover. He was still thinking things over and typing at the keypad of the locked door like a champion speed typist when he was tapped hard on the shoulder. "Ah!" he shouted, leaping around. There were two of them, in walkers and scratched old helmets. Through their faceplates he could see them, a woman with a face like a hawk's who looked like she would be happy to bite him, and a short, thin-faced black man with gray dreadlocks crowding the border of his faceplate like the rope picture frames one sometimes sees in nautical restaurants. It was the man who had tapped Art on the shoulder. Now he lifted three fingers pointing at his wrist console, the intercom band they were using, no doubt. Art switched it on. "Hey," he cried, feeling more relieved than he ought to, considering that this was probably Nergal's setup so that he had never been in danger. "Hey, I seem to be locked out of my car. Could you give me a lift?" They stared at him. The man's laugh was scary. "Welcome to Mars," he said.
This ends side one of cassette four. Please turn the cassette over and start side two at the same point.